When I sat down to write my blog post on the spare rib jumper, known as the woman's woolly, I didn't expect to uncover as much as I did, or write as much as I did. Over the course of 4 blog posts, it came in at about 7,500 words. For context, that's about the length of an undergrad university dissertation. Which is a lot. And it's a lot to ask people to read, no matter how interesting I may think it is. So, in the interest of making this more accessible, be that because you find reading that much difficult, or because finding enough time to sit and read with nothing else going on just isn't doable for you right now, I decided to sit down and record my blog posts into a listenable form. If you're listening on the Glasgow Women's Library podcast feed, all my sources are linked in the episode notes. Otherwise, this recording is pretty much identical to the blog posts, but with a few tweaks to make it more audio-friendly. I hope you enjoy listening to it as much as I enjoyed writing and recording it. I'm Becky Mail, and this is Knitting the Woman's Woolly. Part 1. Pearls of Feminist History. The idea of knitting up patterns to add to our museum collection was something that had been floated back when I started volunteering at Glasgow Women's Library in early 2019. No pattern had really jumped out at me, though. If I was translating a written pattern into a physical object, something to be shared with others, it felt important that it should say something about women in craft. Over the years, I've knitted several vintage patterns for myself, but for that, it's enough that they just be attractive. This pattern needed to be something more. That pattern is The Woman's Woolly, a 1982 pullout from the UK feminist magazine Spare Rib. Our copy was donated to us by Shirley Henderson, and she talks beautifully about the place of knitting and women's magazines in her life in her own blog post, Spare Ribbing, Unpicking the Woman's Woolly. This one, more than any other single pattern in our collection, doesn't just say something about women in craft, it bellows it. Initially, I thought this would be a quick blog post about the choices I made in making this jumper, just my musings on knitting it up. Turns out that's part two. First though, there's a whole lot more going on in the 2 pages of pattern than just the instructions. As you've taken the time to listen this far, you're probably a little interested in knitting, but many others won't. Maybe there's a belief somewhere in the back of their minds that a focus on handcrafts weakens feminism, reinforces ideas around women in the home, when really we should be smashing our way out of that box. It's not a new tension, as textile researcher Dr. Alison Main explores in her article, Stitchy Fingers, Making by Hand in the First Decade of Spare Rib. The anti-capitalist desires of the 1970s for self-sufficiency butted uncomfortably up against a second-wave feminism that sought to liberate women from domesticity. Maybe sewing your own clothes is, as Main puts it, a way to engage in the radical act of demonstrating alternative lifestyles. Or maybe it's just your mother's dressmaking in modern prints. And that was the dilemma the 1970s editors faced. This is the last knitting pattern Spare Rib published, and although it was part of the first edition of 1982, there's still a definite late 70s feel to the Woman's Woolly. I've worked with quite a lot of vintage patterns that GWL holds, and one of the things I've learned is that older patterns often lack clear dates. You quickly learn to date them by the photos and styling. With this pattern, those pictures tell a story all of their own. 2 black and white pictures accompany the pattern. In the first, a white woman with a dark, shaggy bob leans against a wall and looks directly into the camera with a slight smile, her hands stuffed in the pockets of her jumper. She's wearing the woman's woolly jumper, almost black in the photo, with a deep V-neck. Around her chest and each bicep is a repeating band of Venus symbols. In the second image, the same woman crouches in front of a brick wall with the words, "If I gave her the wool, would she make me one too?" graffitied on it. These images were taken by playwright and photographer Jill Posner. Her work is currently part of the Tate exhibition Women in Revolt on women's activist art in the 70s and 80s. Later in her career, she would edit Nothing But the Girl with Susie Bright, a collection of lesbian erotic photographs and biographies, which today you can't buy for under 3 figures. Believe me, I've looked. But in 1981, she was working on Spray It Loud, a photographic collection of radical and political graffiti. She took the famous image of the Fiat advertising billboard that said, "If it were a lady, it would get its bottom pinched," with the words, "If this lady was a car, she'd run you down," spray-painted underneath. It's actually the first image of the chapter in Spray It Loud on women's graffiti, and she thanks Spare Rib in the book's acknowledgements. This says to me that the choice to photograph the jumper in front of a piece of graffiti is obviously inspired by her work at the time. "If I gave her the wool, would she make me one too?" is also the punchline to a very old joke in queer circles, extinct by the time I came out, which begins, "My mother made me a homosexual." The joke goes, "My mother made me a homosexual. If I gave her the wool, would she make me one too?" In this second image, Posner's subverting the domesticity of knitting, joking with queer women in the know, referencing bigger trends in political street art, and illustrating how your finished garment is supposed to look. I suspect most of the women involved with this jumper and photo shoot would balk at the idea that I'm about to talk about their clothing choices as fashion. In her post, Lesbian Feminist Dress Codes, fashion historian Eleanor Medhurst, aka Dressing Dykes, makes a similar point when talking about what became the uniform of a particular group of feminists of the 70s and 80s. They attempted to opt out of fashion entirely by embracing the opposite of everything they were supposed to wear as women and becoming so ugly that they would free themselves from the male gaze. The problem with that approach is that there is no opting out. Whatever you wear says something about you, whether you intend it to or not. Although there was never any explicitly stated dress code for second wave feminism, one emerged nonetheless, as Elizabeth Wilson explores in her article from 1987, Feminism and Fashion. It was a style of dress that communicated your politics to those around you and called to your tribe, "I'm one of you." In rejecting fashion, they made a fashion all of their own. So, why am I taking the time to talk about fashion? Well, because the model for the jumper is wearing it, and I'd argue, wearing the uniform of late 1970s lesbian feminists. Yes, this pattern was made and photographed in 1981, but fashion, and especially anti-fashion, doesn't get revamped for the new decade at midnight on the 31st of December. Skipping over the jumper for now, I'll come back to it in part two, I promise. Let's focus on the model and what she's wearing. Even in a black and white picture, we can make a few assumptions. She's wearing blue jeans and a wide collared shirt with short, shaggy, dark hair. And what she isn't wearing matters too, little to no makeup and minimal jewellery. This simple androgyny was the feminist, and more specifically lesbian feminist, uniform of the late 1970s, as described in Betty Luther Hillman's 2013 article, "The Clothes I Wear Help Me to Know My Own Power, The Politics of Gender Presentation in the Era of Women's Liberation." One thing the photographs don't show us are the bottom of her jeans or her footwear. Boots were often the preferred form of sensible footwear, but trainers weren't uncommon either. Practical and explicitly unfeminine, like the rest of the uniform. Jeans in the 50s and 60s, including on women, had been rebellious and countercultural, but by the late 70s and early 80s, they'd become so widespread as to have lost their teeth, as Valerie Steele sets out in her article, Anti-Fashion, the 70s, from 1997. As something everyone wore, they were invisible, and therefore not fashion. Even within jeans, though, there are trends, and without being able to see more of the model's ones, it's hard to know if these adhere to any of them. But I can make a few inferences from the pictures. She can crouch in them, so they're probably not cut tighter around the hips and bum specifically for women. Lycra was only just starting to be incorporated into denim, and even then it was mostly reserved for high fashion, not street-level feminists. They're most likely a pair of Levi's or Wranglers, unisex, boot cut or straight leg. Even in the black and white photo, they're a lot paler than the jumper, closer to the shirt. Dark indigo denim had slipped out of favour, replaced by lighter shades of blue. Even when trying to avoid fashion, feminists were still at its whims, whether they realised it or not. I'll be honest with you, I spent significantly more time than it warranted reading up on the shirt. It's a wide collar, much wider than anything you'd find in the 21st century, and one of the things that, for me, says 70s about these photos, even though they're from 1981. Everything I found told me that collar points got really long in the 60s and 70s, but none of them could really tell me why. Which means I now get to give you my best guess from what I know, which is this. Menswear underwent the biggest experimentation with colour and shape since the 18th century, sometimes known as the Peacock Revolution, and began to redefine what masculinity was in clothing. At the same time, women were increasingly co-opting and wearing clothing designed for men for comfort, practicality, and politics. Women's collars got big because men's got big, and a wide-collared shirt became a unisex fashion item. Like the jeans, our model is dressed in a shirt that, by this point, had lost many of its connotations of gender. Even before I've cast on, that is, started knitting, the images that accompany the pattern itself are telling a story of feminist resistance, feminist art, feminist fashion, and feminist creativity. Unfortunately, the same can't necessarily be said for the jumper itself, but that's part two. Part 2. P1, R1. Progress 1, regress 1. In several languages, a knitting pattern is called a recipe. Like with food, there are aspects you don't change. A paella without rice is no longer a paella. But a skilled cook knows exactly where they can tweak it, which vegetable will work in place of another, how much salt will improve or ruin it. It becomes more than a written set of instructions. Instead, it's an expression of the cook's creativity, experience, and personality. How many dishes just taste better when cooked by a certain someone in your life? That's the difference the cook makes. And for a knitting pattern, the knitter has those same choices too. At the risk of making this too technical, I'm going to attempt to tell you about those choices, about why I made them, and why I think they matter here, more so than for any other pattern I've knitted. I'm recreating something from the past, at least that's the goal. It will never be a perfect replica of that moment in time, but it can get pretty damn close. When I've made other vintage and historical patterns, I've not worried over much about accuracy. I'm making something for myself to wear because I like them. The finished garment is the goal, not the technical process. With this jumper though, it matters to me that it reflects the written pattern as closely as possible. This isn't going to be presented as a jumper from 1981. It's a jumper of the spare rib pattern, and a way for non-knitters to better understand the code we communicate our craft in. First step is to pick the materials. The pattern specifies pure wool, which jumped out at me as a little unusual. Bri nylon was introduced in the late 50s, and the fibre content of yarns underwent a radical shift as more man-made fibres entered the marketplace. Suddenly, knitwear could be washable, moth-proof, and all kinds of interesting textures. Wool blended with other things was, by this point, so common that I find it notable that the pattern specifies pure wool. As for why, I don't know. Maybe something about the rustic nature of it appealed to the designer. If that's the case, then I need to pick a yarn with those qualities. Something unfussy, maybe with a little scratch. For some years, my first stop when I need a workhorse yarn is the Norwegian company Drops, so their Drops Alaska yarn seems like a perfect choice. It's 100% wool, with all the same qualities I'm looking for, and comes in a variety of colours. The pattern suggests the colours navy, burgundy, and grey. So that's what I go for. Navy blue for the body, and pearl grey and burgundy for the Venus symbol band. With my yarn chosen, I knit up a tension square. Before you make anything, it's recommended you knit a 10cm by 10cm piece using the same needles and yarn you're going to make your finished garment in. That way, you know that your finished measurements will match the designer's ones, and you won't get a jumper that's wildly bigger or smaller than you'd planned. So, with my tension on point and my needles ready to go, it's time to cast on. There's a joke in knitting circles. Everyone casts on the same. Really? Which one do you use? The one my mum, /granny, /the woman in the shop, delete as appropriate, taught me. most people can't name their cast on, it's just the one they use, a tactile tradition passed on from woman to woman. There's a few different ones used commonly, but most people just consider it casting on. I have a few favourite cast-ons, but something told me it'd be worth checking which ones would be most in use in the late 70s and early 80s. One of the benefits of being a Glasgow Women's Library volunteer is having easy access to the archives and the many, many knitting patterns and publications that have been donated over the years. These are going to be my reference guides. Before I do anything, I need to double check with them that the technique I'm using is appropriate. It's a strange way to knit. My hands will happily do an action they've done hundreds of times before with very little input from my brain, but now I'm asking them to wait while I check if they're allowed to do it like that. To pick my cast on, I check a few publications. Your Guide to Better Knitting, a 1964 pullout from the magazine Woman's Own. Knitting Fashion, a step-by-step guide to knitting and crochet, a 1976 book published to accompany a BBC series. And Golden Hands, a multi-craft magazine published from 1971 to 1973 and republished throughout the decade. Golden Hands is a fascinating publication covering knitting, crochet, dressmaking, embroidery, various forms of lace making, and that 70s classic macrame. Each issue introduced a new technique to build your skills and patterns on which to try them out. Chatting to women who crafted in the 70s, diving into archives and private collections, and stumbling across them in charity shops, their popularity is undeniable. But their importance seems to have been neglected by academia. There's plenty on craft in women's magazines, but almost nothing on craft magazines from this period. From my sources, I pick a long-tail cast-on, also known by at least half a dozen other names. It's the stretchiest of the ones described, but wouldn't be my first choice to start a jumper. Then I knit my way up the back piece, first with a stretchy rib, and then changing to a bigger needle and knitting the body of the jumper. I leave little stitch markers every 10 rows to keep track of how many I've done. The first surprise of this jumper comes when I get ready to start the distinctive band of Venus symbols. It tells me to work 2 rows, C1 in GST. I read it again, and then reread it again. C1 refers to the burgundy yarn. I was expecting to start the grey here. But it also wants me to work in GST, which means in garter stitch. Instead of going straight into the motif, there's a little ridge in a contrasting colour. It's a lovely little design element, completely invisible in the black and white photos. It's also the first time that my decision to do this project really pays dividends. Even with all my experience, just reading the pattern through, I completely missed that until I actually knitted it up. It's the most visually striking part of the pattern, but technically speaking, the motif is nothing special. You could really replace it with any symbol and it would still work. I'll talk more about this in part 4, how the finished garment was always more important than the process and the ways yarn companies shaped the process of knitting in the 20th century. It is worth saying, though, that stranded knitting, knitting with 2 colours on the same row without cutting the yarn in between, is not a beginner's technique. In fact, as I knit, I realised that none of this pattern is really written for a beginner knitter. Its boxy shaping is simple enough, but the tightness of the language isn't accessible to a newer knitter. I'm reminded of the even older patterns I've read that assume a certain level of competency and familiarity with patterns and pattern reading. If you don't know how to do something, this pattern isn't going to help you, nor is it going to tell you where to find help. This also isn't the this-is-how-you-do-this-skill type piece that crops up in earlier issues of Spare Rib. You're expected to know how to knit already. While wearing the Venus band on the jumper is undeniably radical, and there can be no doubt about the political leanings of any woman who does, the pattern itself, in its writing and construction, is still fairly conservative. It is, to reuse a phrase from part 1, your mother's knitting with a modern motif. I continue up the back, and it's all pretty straightforward and familiar. When I start the front piece, the pockets are the first difference to the back. They're not recommended for inexperienced knitters and only just visible in the photos, but to me, they are as much a feminist statement as the Venus motif. This is where I get to talk about pockets, or, more importantly, the lack of pockets in women's clothes. The exchange, "I love your dress," "thanks, it has pockets," has become a meme in its own right, simply because of the dearth of them in women's wear. Even when we have them, they're smaller than in clothes in the menswear section. This hasn't always been the case, and it turns out the history of pockets is long and complex, touching on ideas of intimacy, class, and gender roles. If you'd like to know more about pockets, I'd very much recommend the book Pockets, An Intimate History of How We Keep Things Close by Hannah Carlson. But to summarise it very, very briefly, when women wore dresses with big skirts, they had what were known as tie-on pockets tucked underneath their petticoats. As silhouettes got sleeker at the start of the 19th century, think Jane Austen, Regency gowns, that sort of thing, tie-on pockets were no longer practical, and reticules, or little drawstring handbags, became the thing, and the pocket never really recovered. Sewn-in pockets show up in women's wear, but they take their cues from tailoring and are far too small to be useful. When we hit the 20th century, the sewn-in pocket continues to be tiny, and women get bigger handbags to compensate. Designers and pattern cutters then refuse to make pockets because they believe it ruins the silhouette of the garment. Today, handbags are the big moneymaker in the fashion industry, and to keep costs down in fast fashion, the pocket is the first thing to go from a design. This leaves us with pockets that are smaller and less useful than those of 17th century women. Which brings me back to the jumper. It has pockets you can put your keys, cash, bus ticket, whatever in. In this regard, it's radical as a garment. The making of the jumper actively subverts the world in which women's needs are dismissed in order to adhere to an aesthetic ideal. Your jumper has pockets because you want them, and you can choose what goes in them. You're not beholden to a designer's ideas of what you need. You become your own designer. What strikes me about this jumper is that it's almost analogous to spare rib itself. Both are attempting to be progressive within more traditional systems. Spare rib was sold in W.H. Smith's and funded by advertising just like other women's magazines. It attempted to communicate progressive ideas inside a typical publishing model. The jumper is doing the same. The motif is radical, the pockets are radical, the construction is not. It's attempting to be progressive inside the confines of the knitting culture of its period, but not expand on that culture. I'm halfway down one arm when I run out of yarn and discover a mistake I made right at the start. My yarn is Aran weight, and the pattern says double knitting pure wool. Aran is about 25% thicker than double knitting. But my tension was perfect, so where did I go wrong? Well, I think the honest answer is that my experience did me dirty. Instead of reading the instruction to knit in DK, I read the needle size and tension and went, oh, that's an Aran. I tripped up by knowing just a smidgen too much about knitting. What difference will it make? Hopefully not as much as it could have. Because my tension is right, the jumper will still end up the right size. The only noticeable issue might be the way the finished fabric drapes. A thinner yarn on bigger needles will give a more open, slouchy knit, but if you don't know I've made the mistake, you wouldn't notice it. I decide against scrapping weeks of work, but I'll make sure I acknowledge my mistake in the notes that will accompany it into the archive. Does this compromise the accuracy of it and my goal of creating a jumper of the spare rib pattern? It might do. At the same time, I might be the only person who'll care. And let's be honest, if I made that mistake, I wouldn't be surprised if someone in 1982 made exactly the same one too. Finally, I have four pieces of fabric, front, back, and two sleeves, ready to sew together to make a jumper. Before I do that though, I have to add the collar. My notes on this step read, I hate this, it is awful, why would anybody do this? With straight needles, I have to pick up and knit across the back of the neck and down the front. In essence, I'm knitting an oval in a straight line. I almost break and get out my circulars, but persevere through the hellish experience. This is one of the techniques we were right to leave in the past. The final step is to sew it all up. And I hate seaming knitting so much, I knitted an entire other jumper in the time I spent avoiding it. Eventually though, I grit my teeth and sew. I hate it just as much as I expected, cursing with each stab of my blunt needle at the use of backstitch and how the inky navy yarn strains my eyes. Eventually though, the pieces of knit fabric join together, forming a jumper. There's a strange nostalgia involved in giving away a piece of knitting. Pride, of course, in a job well done, but sadness too, knowing that this item you've spent hours on, each yard of yarn slipping through your fingers, will soon be gone. It lives in your mind forever in that moment, just before you hand it over. A perfectly preserved piece of knitting that you both hope and fear is still like that. Fear that it's so unloved that it's completely unaltered by time and wear. Hope that the recipient loved it enough to care for it. Giving the jumper to the women's library means that my mental image of it will likely match the real garment forever. It won't be worn or wear out, but it also won't be neglected and unloved. Its purpose is different to every other jumper I've made. It's not keeping anyone warm, it's stitching together different fields of knowledge. And anyway, I loved it so much, I made another. That's part three. Part three, ribbed for my pleasure. Making a jumper for someone else is an intimate act. Even setting aside the cost and time, you're making thousands of tiny stitches by hand that will lie across its wearer's shoulders, wrap around their body, and hug their figure. To make a jumper for yourself is to turn all of that intimacy onto your own body and sheathe it in your own decisions. Decision number one, what do I want it to look like? It's one of the great freedoms that come from making your own clothes. You get to make exactly what you want to wear, not what a fashion buyer thinks you'll want to wear when you're in the shops. The woman's woolly comes with two versions, the one I've already made and a pullover, the same jumper but made sleeveless. I'm not short on jumpers, but I haven't made a sleeveless one in a while, and something about its slouchy shape appeals to me. Sleeveless jumpers turn up about every 20 years with a startling regularity. In the Women's Library archives, we have examples from the 1920s with a very fashionable deep neck and dropped waist. In the 1940s, wartime rationing limited the amount of wool available, making sleeveless jumpers popular, and patterns often incorporated multicoloured Fair Isle motifs to use up valuable scraps of yarn. The 1970s jumpers are deliberately referencing back to those simpler times of their parents, but often use brighter colours and patterns in line with the Peacock Revolution. The most famous sleeveless jumpers of the 90s were seen in the movie Clueless, figure-hugging and machine-knitted, evoking a particular American Ivy aesthetic. The current crop of sleeveless jumpers turned up on runways in about 2016 and, as with all things high fashion, have slowly made their way into the mainstream. In the last 3 years, there's been no end of articles on how to style a sleeveless jumper. Most noticeably different from previous incarnations is the square shoulder. Instead of following the line of a shirt seam, it instead stops partway down the upper arm, creating a more relaxed punk look. It's exactly the way the spare rib pullover is constructed. Our 1980s jumper is on trend for the 2020s. With that settled on, I then get to pick what colours I want for my jumper. This one needs to be me, and I'm not really a navy and grey kind of woman. In fact, nobody who has ever met me would describe me as quiet. These days, my style reflects that, so I go hunting for a yarn that's as loud as I am. I settle on West Yorkshire Spinner's Colour Lab DK, another of my favourite workhorse yarns, in Cerise Pink. My teenage self would be appalled that I chose pink. She grudgingly accepted her womanhood and fiercely rejected any connection between softness and femininity. A girlhood spent in boys' clothes, avoiding the colour of Barbie and ballet, grew into an adolescence wrapped in black velvet, accented with red and purple. Both periods were constrained by strict rules, a way to place limits on the infinite possibilities of this vast thing called fashion, but also to forcibly expand the boundaries of this thing called girl. If I had to be one, I would not be pink, I would not be sweet, I would be more. So why, then, would I make this jumper in pink? The facetious answer would be, because I want to. The honest answer is that the girl who spent so much time not being like other girls grew into a woman who realised that there was nothing wrong with other women. Villainising femininity and its trimmings as weak hadn't made me strong. It wasn't its softness that held women back, but the degradation of that softness. When I read Eleanor Medhurst's post, Subverting Pink, on the relationship between lesbians and pink, the first thing that came to mind was Dolly Parton. Stay with me, I am going somewhere with this. Medhurst argues that by choosing to wear pink, including in a purposefully exaggerated way, lesbians undermine the heterosexist femininity typically associated with the colour. which is where Dolly comes in. Find out who you are and do it on purpose. By doing pink on purpose, we rob it of its constrictions. It can't be sweet and delicate and straight on a body that doesn't conform to those things either. As Medhurst puts it, wearing pink has the potential to recreate the meaning of a symbol that has been used to oppress us. I could go into the history of pink as a colour in fashion, its shifting relationship to gender, and its reclamation by queers and punks, but this is already long enough and not actually relevant to my choice to knit a pink jumper. Its historical position is interesting and undeniably important in its own right. However, I'm not creating a piece of history. I am creating a current piece I'm going to wear. My relationship to the jumper and to the colour, and to a lesser extent, the reaction of the audience who sees it, has more relevance here than pink in a historical context. Being purposeful in my clothing choices and what they might say has become an important part of my philosophy of dressing. As I've gotten older, like many women, I've begun to care less about what other people think about what I wear. Whereas for many women, that means wearing what they like because it's comfy or practical and liberating themselves from fickle trends, which is valid, even if, as I established in part one, it doesn't totally mean they've opted out of fashion. For me, clothes have become play, and with it, so has femininity. It can be hard, sharp lines, crisp darts, carnal colours, and masculinity can be soft, and I can pick them up and put them down at my whim. My clothes can be referential. A pinstripe button-down shirt shouts 80s capitalist greed or aggressive machismo. My clothes can subvert. That same shirt unbuttoned to my sternum with a lace vest peeking out from beneath and worn jeans blurs away that formality and machismo into something else. My clothes can be anything I want, a semiotics of stitches for anyone ready to read them. So not only is this jumper deliberately pink, I want it to be symbolically loud in other ways. The feminism of the late 70s and early 80s could be a little one note, focused on the needs of white women, often from middle class backgrounds. Modern feminism, my feminism, is intersectional, or at least it aspires to be. It recognises the complexities of women's lives and how other aspects of women's identities impact on them. It also acknowledges that woman isn't necessarily a binary concept. And all of that is a lot to ask of a jumper. It's a lot to express in words, never mind yarn. But taking that concept of one note, I begin to adapt the Venus symbol into a symphony of gender. Each is a six-stitch repeat, so I start with one of the older symbols, the interlocking Venuses, to symbolise lesbians. Then I create the combined Mars and Venus symbols of the trans symbol. My last two symbols are for non-binary and intersex people. One, a simple circle with a star on the top. The other, the Mercury symbol, similar to the female symbol but with horns on top, has been used to symbolise certain non-binary genders too, so it's doing double duty here. I'm not removing the Venus. It's still the major motif of the jumper. I'm just augmenting what's already there with our greater understanding of gender. There will be 25 Venuses on the jumper and 4 new symbols when it's finished. I test them with some scrap yarn. The double Venus and the Mercury symbol knit up perfectly, but the trans symbol and the other non-binary one look too crowded. I decide to knit parts of the symbols, but I'll go in afterwards and sew the details on. I know what's going on the band, but at this point I don't know what the band is going to look like. The pink is settled, but the yarn for the rest of it is yet to be determined. What I do know, however, is that I want to reflect another modern shift in knitting, the indie dyer. I'm going to come back to this in more detail in part 4 because it's directly related to other changes in the culture of knitting. But what you need to know is that there is an entire industry of, mostly, women hand-dyeing individual skeins of yarn in interesting colours all over the world. If you can picture a colour combination, someone has probably dyed it. As well as selling online, indie dyers also come together at yarn festivals where, mostly, women congregate to buy yarn, show off their proudest creations, and talk about having spent far too much on indie yarn. The amount of times I've heard this phrase is unreal. Do men have this level of guilt about their hobbies? Glasgow's local festival is Glasgow School of Yarn. I'd planned on attending the 2023 event anyway, but decide it's my best chance to find something for the project. Glasgow School of Yarn is held in the Jordan Splendour of the Trades Hall. It's home to Trades House, the umbrella organisation established in the 16th century to represent the skilled craftsmen of Glasgow. And I use the term craftsmen deliberately. The youngest of the crafts is the bonnet makers and dyers, who, along with bonnets, was responsible for knitted stockings, underwear, and similar wool garments. And although women have always been a part of the textile industries, the bonnet makers and dyers didn't officially admit their first female member until 2003. It's not lost on me that the women filling this space and keeping its craft and traditions alive are the same ones it spent centuries excluding. Stall after stall, bejeweled in kaleidoscopic yarns, fills panelled room after panelled room. Wearing my newly finished Victorian jumper, I told you I've knit a few historical patterns, I make a beeline for the stall of For the Love of Yarn, a dyer whose studio is based a few streets from GWL in Bridgeton. The idea of knitting this with yarn dyed so close to the library is just too wonderful a chance to pass up. I explain the project to her, and she helps me pick out a skein of her double knit. After weighing a few options, I settle on Royal Flush, a beautiful set of blues and pinks with splashes of yellow and purple. Something about it reminds me of different pride flags, and when paired with the cerise, the contrast's delicious. For my third colour, I decide on white. This isn't for any ideological or symbolic reason. I just finished knitting a baby blanket and have some left over. It's not as strong of a contrast as between the grey and the burgundy, but I like it. And it's not like the jumper needs to be any louder at this point. Like with the original spare rib jumper, even before I've started to knit, this jumper is telling a story. Except this time, it's my story. My story, my politics, my performance of gender, my body, my creativity. It's deeply personal, but simultaneously deliberately connected to other ideas out with just myself. And somehow that feels even more in the spirit of the original jumper than the 80s replica now in the GWL collection. So I suppose I better get on and knit it. That's part four. Part 4. Re-knitting the woman's woolly. I already described in part 2 that the knitter makes small choices all the way through the process, technical preferences peculiar to them. Whereas for the archive jumper, I wanted to erase my presence from it to let the written pattern sparkle through. For a jumper I intend to wear myself, I get to make it my own way. A lot has changed in the world of knitting over the last 40 years. It was just starting when the pattern was written, a shift away from a market dominated by yarn producers who made the knitter invisible, the designer anonymous, and who gave you a pattern to be followed exactly as written and made only with their yarns. It didn't leave knitters much scope for self-expression or to alter a pattern to fit a body that wasn't a commercial ideal. Even into the 90s and into the early 2000s, it was still common for patterns to be knitted as flat pieces of fabric and sewn together. This is because these yarn companies were using dressmaking techniques in their designs. Improving the skill of their customers and using the medium to its best advantage wasn't a priority for them. They were interested in selling yarn in the end product, not the process of knitting. If you would like to read more about this, I'd recommend Lily Marsh's chapter in Stitching the Self, Identity in the Needle Arts, called Become the Boss of Your Own Knitting, Elizabeth Zimmerman and the Emergence of Critical Knitting. The biggest change has been the internet. People whose knitting traditions contain different techniques could share them internationally with other knitters. Suddenly, we went from 3 cast-ons to a dozen, each suitable for different things. Knitters from a range of backgrounds began to experiment with and push the limits of the medium. The rise of big-name designers would have been impossible in an industry that was still centered on the needs of the yarn manufacturers. With the change in techniques, the market for materials changed. Double-pointed needles were regularly used for gloves, hats, and socks, so you can knit a single piece without seams by going in a continuous circle rather than back and forth. But it's not until the 1970s that circular needles really show up in the UK. Even then, it needed a whole booklet of patterns, and we have one in the GWL archive, in order for knitters to see their potential. This new connectivity, alongside international knitwear designers who think of the finished garment as a 3D object and know that the process is as important as the product, means that most modern patterns are knitted without seams. The other shift in materials came from the movement for independent dyers, aka indie dyers. Dyeing has long been the poor cousin of the textile arts, often seen as part of the process of another creation and lacking the romance of spinning or weaving, rather than recognised as a skill in its own right. With the Industrial Revolution and the move to synthetic dyes, women continue the traditions of small batch and natural dyes, but it often got subsumed into other domestic labour, meaning their contributions and techniques have not been preserved in the same way. Other changes in knitting have been pretty extensively covered, but dyeing has been neglected. It shows up as one of the crafts in the 1970s magazine Golden Hands, but that's mostly focused on tie-dye and batik cloth dyeing, not yarn. As I said, the early 2000s and the rise of the internet changed the cultural shape of knitting, and craft more broadly. Knitters sought to reconcile and reconnect the aesthetic and political values of craft. As Doreen Jacob puts it in Crafting Your Way Out of the Recession, New Craft Entrepreneurs and the Global Economic Downturn from 2013, which meant that not only what and how you made was changing, but also what you knitted with. This isn't the anti-capitalist countercultural crafting of the 1970s that I touched on in part one. It is, however, a more intentional form of consumption that centres the small businesses of women, be it through designing patterns, dyeing yarn, or running local yarn shops, also known as LYSs. There is a conversation to be had around class and which women have access to these types of craft spaces, but that would be a whole essay in its own right. In the wake of the 2008 global financial recession, many people attempted to turn their hobby into a business, usually for supplementary income. Sites like Etsy became a key place to sell handmade products, including yarn, and the knitting social platform Ravelry has, as of February 2024, just shy of 1.3 million patterns in their database, many of which are available to purchase on the site. Yarn, however, is a tactile object, and two of the most important factors are its colour and feel. It's normal in an LYS to be encouraged to squish the yarn to get a good feel of it. Colour on a screen isn't reliable. You often need to see it in person to really know if it's right for you. LYSs tend to stock smaller brands and indie dyers, who in turn benefit from their presence in LYSs. The internet has had a huge impact, but it is in these offline spaces that women's businesses interact and make space for each other. All of which is a rather long-winded way of saying that, in the 40 years since the spare rib jumper was published, knitters have reclaimed the methods of production, the materials of production, and their economic power within knitting. For me, the change in knitting methods is a godsend because, I'm going to let you in on a little secret, I am incredibly lazy. Which means I will do everything in my power to avoid seams, even modifying a pattern so I don't have to do any sewing at the end. That's what I'm going to do with my version of the woman's woolly. It will have no seams. And because I've already decided to knit the pullover, I won't be knitting any more sleeves either. As I started writing about this, I realised explaining the difference between each technique was going to be incredibly boring for everyone involved. Experienced knitters will be familiar with some of them and don't need me to explain all of my idiosyncrasies to them. Not every change is worth going into in depth. My preference for one decrease over another isn't really that interesting. And for non-knitters, having to explain the difference between them is going to be equally dull. So I made a handy little chart so knitters can see what I've changed and I can get on with talking about the process of making the jumper. However, this is audio, so you can't see the chart. If you'd like to see the chart itself, it's available in part four of the spare rib blog posts. It's a little table with one column with the technique in the old jumper and one technique in the new jumper. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick out the important things to note. The original I used a long tail cast on, for this one I used a German twisted, which has a lot more spring to it. I changed some of the decreases, did some more frequently. Instead of bothering with weaving in ends, I used what's known as a Russian join because that's just my preference for how I join balls of yarn together. Instead of casting off in rib, I used what's known as Jenny's surprisingly stretchy bind off. And I did a little bit of shaping on the armholes and grafted the shoulders together. Back to my old reliable cast on for jumper bottoms, I cast on for both sides simultaneously. As the pattern repeat is a multiple of 6, I drop the seam stitch and cast on exactly 180 stitches. From there, it's identical to the first jumper, only I'm going round and round rather than back and forth. I skip the pockets, not for any ideological reason, I just can't be bothered with them. Again, I'm a lazy knitter. Already by the time I start the band, I can feel the difference in the way the fabric drapes. It's looser and more relaxed than the original. It's entirely because of the mistake I detailed in part two, but I like it. It fits the aesthetic I'm aiming for better than something more densely knitted would. However, because the contrast between my two colours is less than the ones on the original jumper, the motif stands out less on the less dense fabric. If it were tighter, it would be more obvious. I know this because I knitted one in a tighter gauge for my teddy bear. Yes, he looks very cute in it. But I don't hate it. Something about forcing people around me to double tape and look closer at the jumper fits with my ideas of clothes as performance. The biggest changes I make come as I separate for the shoulders. Now, instead of going round and round, I'm going back and forth across half the stitches. What I realise is that, as I have quite a big bust but narrow shoulders, if I knit the jumper as written, I'm going to end up with a sleeveless jumper that reaches my elbows. As I knit up the back, I decrease a few stitches at each end to narrow the shoulders. Not only have I now altered the jumper to fit my personality, I've altered it to fit my body as well. Once I've done the front with the same alterations to the shoulders, it's time for the finishing touches. Unlike with the original, I'm actually excited for this part. I graft the shoulders together and then move on to the neck and armholes. If you've heard part two, you know how much I detested this part on straight needles. But on my modern circulars, it's a doddle. Circular needles working on circular holes. The last step before sewing in the handful of ends is to embroider on the final details to the trans and non-binary symbols. I use a little of the white yarn and a change stitch to finish them off. Each stitch brings me closer to the end of this process, and with it, the end of this project. I have two finished jumpers, one at GWL and one in my wardrobe. But what I also have is more than that. I've fallen down rabbit holes, spent hours and hours reading papers and finding books on many aspects of fashion and social history. It's been everything I love about research. Pleasure, frustration, obsession, inspiration. In these blog posts, I've attempted to shape what I've learnt, supplemented with my own knowledge and experience, into something accessible for knitters and non-knitters alike. And those moments when my brain fires with an insight and I have to catch it, mould it, give voice to it, has been just as enjoyable to me as using my needles and fingers to shape yarn into jumpers. Both have been acts of creation, built on the work and knowledge of other women. So, yes, I've made two jumpers. But I've gotten so much more out of this project than just that. And I hope you have too. Thank you for listening to this audio recording of the Knitting the Women's Woolly blog posts. All four are available on the GWL website, womenslibrary.org.uk. I'd like to thank the Women's Library staff and other volunteers for all their help and encouragement. For more information on Glasgow Women's Library and our other events and projects, please go to our website, womenslibrary.org.uk.